This is Kurt Benrud welcoming you to another program of the Triangle Radio Reading Service.
This is Pam Vesper. This program has been designed for a print and visually impaired audience.
And this is Bob Martin. This program is a mixture of potpourri, history, narrative, folklore and legend, and just plain fun. And we call it Did You Know?
Previously, we did a show featuring American legend with stories about Paul Bunyan, Johnny Appleseed, and John Henry, and a lot of plain old country tall tales.
And when we got finished, we still had lots of material left over. Literally, we had piles and piles of stories all around here, and we didn't have any idea what to do with all those piles.
Well, I told them what to do with the piles. Oh, ow! But they decided differently. So, here is another session of Legends and Tall Tales.
Some of our most famous stories come from the frontiers of the Old West, so we're going to start there. And what we find is a lot of stories that got told were attributed to people like Daniel Boone, Kit Carson, Jim Bridger.
And some of the even truer stories to Pecos Bill and Paul Bunyan. You see, for the storyteller, the names weren't important, but the stories were. This was America, busting at her straps and straining to be great.
And some of the stories came from an innate difference and suspicion between the locals and the city slickers on the edge of the frontier. Such were the stories of the Arkansas Traveler. Hey, Ma.
Yeah, Pa.
Looks like we got another of those city fellers coming up the road.
Yep. Better go see what he wants. Can I help you, stranger?
Which road do I take to Little Rock?
Don't know, but there's a mighty big one just down the road a piece.
No. I mean, which of these roads do I take to get to Little Rock?
You don't take neither one of them. They got one there already.
Have you been in an accident lately?
No, he always looked like that.
Well, I call that two-faced.
Stranger, if I had two faces, do you think I'd wear this one?
Well, my wife says I'm the best-looking man in the world.
Well, I got bad eyesight, too.
Now, listen. My wife's an angel.
You're lucky. Mine's still living.
Now, just a minute. I'll have you know that I have the face of an 18-year-old boy.
Well, you better give it back. You're getting it all wrinkled.
Now, wait a minute. I hear there's a lot of wild animals down here in Arkansas. Have you ever hunted bear?
No, but I went fishing once just in my shorts.
Is it true that an alligator won't attack you if you carry a torch?
Depends on how fast you carry it.
Now that reminds me. Down the road I saw a horse with a broken leg. Don't you shoot a horse with a broken leg?
No, we shoot him with a shotgun.
Say, look up there. Your roof needs mending. Why don't you mend your roof?
Well, I can't go out and mend it in the rain.
And when it ain't raining, it don't need mending.
Never mind. Just tell me, which way is it to Little Rock?
Don't know.
You don't know much of anything, do you?
No, but we ain't lost.
There's not much between you and a fool, is there?
Only thing I see is this here fence that you're standing on the other side of.
How dare you call me a fool? I'll have you know I went to college, stupid.
Yeah, and you came back stupid.
Did you know that Daniel Boone was once asked if he had ever been lost, and he replied, "No, never been lost, but I was bewildered once for 3 days."
Did you know Davy Crockett once told the story of how he and some friends were riding down the road talking? Davy had recently gotten out of a session of Congress where he said that all those men did was talk, and everything they said just went in one ear and out the other. And you heard old Davy right. He didn't say in one ear. He said in one year.
And out the other. Well, they stopped their talking when they heard the sound of a fiddle somewhere down the road. So they sped up to see where it was a-coming from. Down the road they went through the trees into a little clearing up to the edge of a river. And there they pulled up short, amazed at what they saw out in the middle of that river.
There was a little rig up to its floorboards in the water, and the occupant, with his back to Davy, playing away on his fiddle. Davy called out to him, and the fiddling stopped, and the man turned around, and they could then see it was the old parson that they once heard fiddling up a storm down in Little Rock. "You missed the crossing!" hollered out Davy. I know, replied the parson.
You go another 10 feet and you're going to drown, called out one of the other men. I know, replied the parson. So what are you going to do? Don't know. I was hoping maybe you could help me out.
Well, Davy and his friend surveyed the situation, strung some ropes, and eased the old parson and his rig out of the water. Once safely on dry land, Davy asked him, now, why in the middle of his predicament was he just sitting there fiddling? He answered that he knew that he could holler until he was hoarse and no one would pay him no better mind at all. But if they heard a fiddle going, they'd come running around to see what was happening.
And Davy and the fellows all laughed, seeing what a good judge of human nature the parson was, because he was right.
Did you know that the story told about a certain trapper might have been Jim Bridger, for all I know? Seems that a trapper came into the area where he hadn't ever been before. So naturally, he didn't know anybody, and nobody knew him. He came up on this little settlement and stopped at this one cabin and asked if they might share a bite to eat. The lady, being a tad suspicious, told him they didn't have anything. All the food was gone.
So the old trapper said he was mighty sorry they were in such terrible straits and offered to help him out. The lady wondered how, with none of his own, he was going to help him out. He then went on to tell her that he knew a recipe for nail soup, and if she had some old nails around, especially rusty ones, he'd make them up a big pot of nail soup to share. So he then built a big fire in the clearing, borrowed a big pot and filled it with water, and threw in a big handful of nails.
He proceeded to stand there, stirring and tasting and generally expressing himself on how good it was starting to taste. By this time, all the ladies in the settlement were standing around watching and wondering what was going to happen next. Suddenly, the trapper straightened up and said, you know, this would sure be a lot better if we had a few cabbage leaves to throw in. Anybody got a few old cabbage leaves?
Well, sure enough, they did. And they even found a couple or a few onions. In they went into the pot. The old trapper kept stirring and humming even louder. Then a couple of the more experienced ladies gathered round and suggested that a few carrots and pole beans and potatoes, oh, definitely potatoes, seemed called for. Well, the trapper shook his head and said that he didn't think that was all necessary, as the soup was already starting to taste mighty good, but as long as they suggested it, and he had learned long ago never to argue cooking with an experienced woman, that those carrots and beans and potatoes and whatever they thought was good was certainly acceptable and would definitely make it a better soup.
Well, about then, some of the menfolks started drifting back into camp, and upon learning what was happening and that this stranger was graciously sharing some of his nail soup with all of them, they thought on it a while and decided that soup was just not good enough for a hungry man. What they needed for a real manhandler was a good stew, and they took it in their heads that a little bit of deer meat that was hanging out in the shed was definitely called for.
Then it started happening that everybody, each one knowing just a little better than the other of what was needed, started throwing things into the pot. And the trapper, being as smart as he was, just sort of gradually stepped back and let the women folk take over, which they did. And when they collectively decided that enough stirring and tasting had been done, they passed out bowls and spoons and a little bit of beer that just happened to be sitting around the poor households, and everybody settled back to what they agreed was the finest meal of nail soup, stew, that any of them had ever tasted.
Well, after a while, the trapper got up, thanked the people for their hospitality, to which they all heartily objected, conferring between themselves one and all that it had been his hospitality and his recipe that they were sharing. And with that he departed, being long and familiarly remembered by that settlement. Now that certainly sounds like it could have been old Jim Bridger, now don't it?
Did you know that back in those days that the Texas Rangers were the toughest law enforcement men in the territory? So one time when a riot broke out around Austin, the mayor sent for a troop of Texas Rangers to stop all this fighting. The next day, the mayor was at the train station eagerly awaiting for the arrival of the reinforcements when off the train stepped one Texas Ranger. The mayor gasped and said, "Just one Ranger?" The Ranger replied, "Well, you only got one riot."
Did you know one day, Davy was riding down alongside the Mississippi when he saw this fellow floating down the river fast asleep in the back of his boat? Now, he hadn't had a good fight in quite a spell and was beginning to feel an itch for one, so he hollered out at him, "You better watch what you're doing, or that boat is going to float away from underneath you and leave you sitting there." He gave Davy a glimpse and told him to mind your own business.
Well, after a few more exchanges, Davy had this fellow so riled up, he ran his boat into the shore and stood there flapping his arms and crowing, "Mister, I can whip my weight in wildcats and ride straight through a crabapple orchard on a streak of lightning. My fingernails is related to a sawmill on my mother's side, and my daddy could lick a steamboat."
And that boy was right where Davy wanted him, and not to be outdone, Davy answered him, "You watch out. In one word, I'm a screamer. I'm half horse, half alligator, and a touch of earthquake thrown in on the side. My daddy could whip any man in Kentucky, and I could whip my daddy, and my mama wore a hoop snake for a handkerchief. I can out-talk a room full of politicians and give them a two-hour head start. I can out-stare a panther, walk like an ox, swim like an eel, run like a fox, yell like an Indian, fight like the devil, dive deeper, stay under longer, and come up drier than any man on either side of the Mississippi. I can even swallow a man whole if you butter his head and pin his ears back."
Well, that did it. They had him a whopper of a fight until Davy heard his wife calling and the other fella heard his, so they both kind of just quit and went their separate ways.
Did you know there's all kinds of fighting? And once back in Kentucky, I got into this talking match with a feller from France who was supposed to be the best talker in all of Europe, what you might call a conniser of talking.
I think that's connoisseur.
Well, whatever you call it. It sounded quite funny to us folks from Kentucky. That's why I challenged him to a match. The judges all settled in with their earplugs and we started talking. A week later, they found the judges all sound asleep, the French feller flat out on the ground dead, and I was bending over him, still whispering in his ear.
Did you know about the train ride I once took through Arkansas? It was the slowest train I was ever on. It stopped at every house, and it was a double house. Then it stopped twice. I called the conductor over and asked what we were stopped for now, and he said there was cattle on the track. A little while later, we were stopped again, so I asked, "Now what?" He said that the cattle we had passed a little while back, well, we caught up with them again. I asked, "Can't this train go any faster?" The conductor said if I wasn't satisfied, I could get off and walk. I told him I would, except that the people I'm going to see aren't expecting me until the train arrives.
Did you know I was on that same train and the conductor came by asking for tickets? I gave him 2 fulls and a half fare. The conductor said the half is for under 12, and he ain't under 12. I told him he was when we started. There was one fellow on the train that got so frustrated that he got off the train and ran a mile down the track and laid down to commit suicide. By the time the train got there, he died of old age.
Did you know I also was on that train? And as I remember, they had 3 grades of passengers, first, second, and third class. Well, we got up to this one hill, and the conductor said, "First class passengers, keep your seats. Second class passengers, get off and walk. Third class passengers, get off and push." But speaking of railroads, that reminds me of the story of one of the greatest railroad engineers.
You must mean Casey Jones.
Did you know they didn't call him Casey because he came from Kansas City, as was often reported?
His name was John Luther Jones from Kaye, Kentucky. And here is his story.
Come all you rounders if you want to hear a story about a brave engineer. Casey Jones was the rounder's name. On a 6 8-wheeler, boys, he won his fame. The caller called Casey at a 4:30, kissed his wife at the kitchen door, mounted to the cabin with his orders in his hand, and he took his farewell trip to the promised land.
Put in your water and shovel in your coal. Put your head out the window and watch those drivers roll. I'll run her till she leaves the rail, 'cause I'm 8 hours late with the Western Mail. He looked at his watch, and his watch was slow. He looked at the water, and the water was low. He turned to the fireman, and he said, "We're going to reach Frisco, but we'll all be dead."
Casey pulled up the Reno Hill. He tooted his whistle with an awful shrill. The switchman knew by the engine's moan that the man at the throttle was Casey Jones. Casey Jones. Casey at throttle. Casey Jones with his orders in his hand. Casey Jones mounted in the cabin. He took his farewell trip to the promised land.
Did you know we have a story today? A fabled story. A tall tale, but with a modern twist. It's called The Unicorn in the Garden by James Thurber. Once upon a sunny morning, a man who sat at his breakfast nook looked up from his scrambled eggs to see a white unicorn with a golden horn gently cropping the roses in the garden. The man went up to the bedroom where his wife was still sleeping and woke her.
"There's a unicorn in the garden eating roses." She opened one unfriendly eye and looked at him. The unicorn is a mythical beast. She turned her back on him. The man walked down the stairs slowly and out into the garden. the unicorn was still there. He was now browsing amongst the tulips. The man pulled up a lily and offered it to the unicorn. The unicorn ate it gravely. With a high heart, because there was a unicorn in his garden, he went upstairs and roused his wife again.
The unicorn ate a lily. His wife sat up in bed and looked at him coldly. "You are a booby," she said, "and I'm going to have you put in the booby hatch." Well, the man, who never liked words like booby or booby hatch, and who liked them even less on a shining morning when there was a unicorn in his garden, thought for a moment and then said, "Well, we'll see about that." And he walked to the door. "He has a golden horn in the middle of his forehead," he told her. Then he walked back to the garden to watch the unicorn, but the unicorn had gone away. The man sat down among the roses and went to sleep.
As soon as the husband had gone out of the house, the wife got up and got dressed as fast as she could. She was very excited, and there was a gloat in her eye. She telephoned the police, and she telephoned a psychiatrist. She told them to hurry to her house and to bring a straitjacket. When the police and the psychiatrist arrived, they sat down in chairs and looked at her with great interest.
"My husband," she said, "saw a unicorn this morning." The police looked at the psychiatrist. The psychiatrist looked at the police. "He told me it ate a lily." The psychiatrist looked at the police. The police looked at the psychiatrist. "He told me it had a golden horn in the middle of its forehead." Just then, the husband came back into the house.
"Did you tell your wife you saw a unicorn?" asked the police. "Well, of course not," the man said. "The unicorn is a mythical beast." At a solemn signal from the psychiatrist, the police leaped from their chairs and seized the wife. They had a hard time subduing her, for she put up a terrible struggle. But they finally did, and they got her into the straitjacket.
"That's all I wanted to know," said the psychiatrist. "I'm sorry, sir, but your wife is as crazy as a jaybird. Take her away." So they took her away, cursing and screaming, and the husband lived happily ever after that.
And the moral of this story is, don't count your boobies until they're hatched. You have anything to add, Bob?
Well, as a matter of fact, now this following story didn't happen in America, but it'd be about a very famous story, and this really did happen. I'm sure you remember the story of Quasimodo, the bell ringer of Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris, and how he saved Esmeralda. Well, it's a sad story about the poor hunchback that nobody wanted around, and he lived all by himself up in the bell towers of Notre Dame. But did you know, in fact, that he was an identical twin? People could not tell them apart. And did you know that the other brother was born first? So, Quasimodo was the younger of the two brothers. And did you know what the older brother's name was? Now, did you?
I have no idea.
It was Moto.
How could we know that?
Well, I told you they were identical twins.
Oh, no, Moto.
Oh, and Quasimodo.
Ow, ow, ow!
You know, I did read something strange about that story.
What was that?
That when Quasimodo first came to the cathedral, the priests had no idea of what to do with him. They thought of the bell ringer's job, but his hands were so deformed he couldn't hold the ropes. They were about to turn him away when he pleaded with them, and they said there was a way he could ring the bells. He backed up in the bell tower, started running across the floor, and then dove out and struck the bell with his face, and it made the most beautiful sound. They asked if he could continue doing that, and he assured them he could. And he did it for so many years that most of the priests who were there when Quasimodo first came to Notre Dame were dead. The bells kept ringing on schedule, and nobody wondered how.
But finally he became so enfeebled that one day he slipped and fell down the tower and crashed to the floor below. Nobody knew who this creature was. Then someone thought of Father Stephen, who'd been there forever. Father Stephen looked down at him, scratched his chin, and thought a minute, and then said, "You know, I don't know the name, but that face rings a bell."
"Hey, hey, hey, I didn't say it."
"You thought it."
"Hey, you know, he might be right."
"Oh, no, not you."
No, just wait a minute. After he mentioned the older brother, I got thinking. And I remember a story that after Quasimodo died, they gave the job to his older brother. Yeah, now it all makes sense.
And then what?
Well, unfortunately, he was an older brother, just as frail, and a week later, down came Moto. They brought Father Stephen back again, and the old priest again examined the situation and commented, "You know something? He's a dead ringer for his brother." Don't say a thing.
You know you deserve it.
I think it's time for something else.
One of the most famous feuds in American history was the historic one between the Hatfields and the McCoys.
It started in 1873 and lasted for many generations and became the symbol for bad blood between families. Did you know how it started? Here it is.
"Blow it, Hatfield. That there ain't your hog."
"Why, ain't it, Randolph McCoy?"
"'Cause it's mine."
"'Tain't."
"'Tis."
"'Tain't."
"'Tis."
"We'll see about that."
"We sure will."
"And that's it?"
"That's it."
"Sounds like our present-day Congress." Oh.
Wait a minute. Maybe we ought to take that squat back. Did you know about the best bird dog that ever lived? It belonged to a North Carolina man, and even though the dog was expecting soon, she hadn't been out for a while and was getting cabin fever. And since the ducks were coming in pretty good, the Carolina lad decided to go out for a short trip. Well, the ducks come up, and he took a couple of quick shots, and off that dog went. Dog didn't come right back, so the feller decided to go back home and wait a spell. The dog always came back home on her own. Next morning, the dog still hadn't come home, so the feller took out looking for her. When he got to the edge of the pond, he parted the grass and looked out, and what do you think he saw? Here come the dog with a duck in her mouth, and behind was swimming five little pups. Each one of them had another duck in its mouth. That was the best bird dog that ever was.
Did you know there was this one time that Davy got outsmarted? He was out hunting and spotted this raccoon out on a branch of a tree. The raccoon knew he was caught. There he was out in the open, and there wasn't any place to hide. He also knew that if he made the slightest quick move, he was a goner. So he thought about it as Davy got closer and just sat there, kind of playing possum, you know. He waited until Davy raised his rifle and called out, "Wait a minute, wait!" Davy lowered his rifle, looked at the raccoon, and said, "You talking to me?"
The raccoon said, "Yes, sir. I wanted to know if you was Davy Crockett." Davy replied that indeed that's who he was. Then the raccoon said, "I thought as much. There's no need to waste a shot. Just wait, and I'll come on down." Well, Davy lowered his rifle and then uncocked it and laid it next to the tree while he waited for the raccoon to get down. Raccoon came down slowly, like he knew it was the last time he was going to come down that tree.
And when he got to the ground, Davy walked over and scratched it behind the ears and said, "Don't worry, little feller. I won't hurt you." And with that, the coon started to back away, but slowly. "Hey," said Davy, "what's your hurry?" The raccoon said, "It's not that I don't believe you, it's just you might change your mind." And with that, the raccoon was gone. Davy did change his mind, but by then it was too late. Even Davy laughed at the situation, but that was the last time Davy ever got outsmarted by a raccoon.
It wasn't always just fighting and hunting back in the early days. There was some romancing, too. And here is a story on how Daniel Boone found his wife. Seems Daniel was out hunting with a friend, and the way they did it was one walked ahead with a torch, and the other followed watching the woods on either side for reflections of the light in the deer's eyes. Well, they were down by the stream that ran by Morgan Bryan's land when Daniel thought he shined one.
Quietly, he crept around behind the animal and waited, and sure enough, there was that light reflected again, and near. He raised his rifle, and just for a minute, he hesitated. Daniel later said it was the only time he'd ever hesitated in his life. Never before had his trigger finger trembled, and tremble it did. Well, with that tremble, the deer took off like the wind, with Daniel fast after it. Through the forest they went, branches cracking and leaves rustling, taking logs and bushes by the jump. But Daniel couldn't bean on that deer.
Suddenly, he came up on Morgan Bryan's cabin, with Morgan's dogs barking, and Daniel out of breath. Morgan came out laughing and told Daniel he'd better come in and set a spell and tell him how come such a young man could be so plumb exhausted. Well, before Daniel could start his story, brother come running in hollering that sister had gone down to the stream to check the fishing lines and had got chased by a cougar or something, and she had to run for her life. Daniel turned and saw those two bright eyes he had shined just a time before. They belonged to Rebecca Bryan. And I guess it would come as no surprise that not long after that, she became Rebecca Boone.
Did you know about the fellow from Tennessee talking about his Kentucky neighbor? He said, I'm not saying the man is dishonest, but he needs someone else to call his hogs.
Did you know about the Scotsman that settled down by Little Rock and opened a general store? The man was so stingy, he was known to pick a flea off the corner and look into the cracks of his feet to see if it was stealing any sugar.
And did you know about the gravesite down by Little Rock? The tombstone said, here lies Sam Jones, an honest man and a good lawyer. Stranger passing through stopped and reflected on the tombstone and then remarked, I didn't think that grave was big enough to hold three bodies.
Did you know what it would have been like to attend the original Wild West show? Well, settle back and imagine. Back in the 1890s, on opening night, 9,000 spectators streamed into the garden, crowding the huge galleries to the roof. In the boxes sat Ward Beecher, General William Tecumseh Sherman, Erastus Winman, Pierce Lorillard, August Belmont, General Philip Sherman, and the widow of General Custer. The overhead beams were draped with flags and bunting. The arena floor was covered with tan bark. From a single stage, the cowboy band, with big hats, chaps, and spurs, played a medley of popular tunes. The music faded, the lights went dim. A ghostly clatter of hoofs filled the vast hall, and from the looming mountains came the rich voice of Buffalo Bill. Ladies and gentlemen, the Wild West presents the unique and unparalleled spectacle of Western life and history, the drama of civilization.
Swinging spotlights, dramatic as a prairie sunset, picked out a group of riders in the scenic entrance. They loped across the plain and pulled up under a purple butte. One spotlight held them there while another swung back to a file of cowboys on half-wild Mustangs, then to a band of Mexican vaqueros, and at last to a party of painted Sioux on shaggy ponies. Each raced around and pulled up at the far end.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Wild West presents the lovely lass of the Western Plains, Little Sure Shot, the one and only Annie Oakley.
The spotlight found her. Tiny, graceful, alive, eye-catching and breath-catching, on a pony under the colored mountains. It raced with her across the tan-bark plain. Now came the voice of Frank Richmond, the master of ceremonies.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Wild West presents the great plainsman, the great hunter, the great Indian fighter, the greatest scout of the Old West, Buffalo Bill!
Amid the fanfare, the majestic plainsman galloped across the arena and halted his white horse on hind feet, 4 feet in the air. The spotlight glittered on the silver bridle, spurs, and silver-mounted saddle. The horse, famed Charlie of the Buffalo Chase, bowed on one knee while Cody swept his Stetson from his flowing hair.
Now the McKay scenario began. Silence and shadow held the empty plain. Then the lights come up like sunrise, showing a primeval forest with bear, antelope, and elk grazing on its edge. Into the scene trotted two bands of Indians. They joined in a friendly dance, which ended abruptly with the attack of a hostile tribe. In silence, the Indian fought with bow and arrows, stone hatchets, and stone-tipped spears. The lights dimmed on a battleground, strewn with the dead and dying.
Then came the first interlude and the first gunfire. Around the ring on an Indian pony raced Annie Oakley in her fringed skirt and flowered deerskin jacket, shattering targets thrown in the air by a companion rider. She leapt to the ground, seized a rifle from her gun stand, and broke 5 glass balls thrown simultaneously into the air. She vaulted over the stand, swung a new gun to her shoulder, and shot the flames off a revolving wheel of candles. She was all swiftness, grace, and magic, on horseback and afoot. When she made her quick little curtsy and ran from the ring on twinkling feet, the roof shook with applause, and the Wild West's first indoor audience had been reassuringly introduced to the sound of firearms. The rest of the show would blaze and crackle.
Scene 2 opened with the coming of the settlers, an immigrant train plodding across the prairie, the wagons pulled into a circle for the night camp. It was a peaceful scene until the Indians came whooping. The whir of arrows was answered by a rattle of rifles, the Indians fell back, but another peril followed. As sunset faded over the plains, a lurid light began. The wagon master cried the alarm, "Prairie fire!" Up in McKay's light towers, the crews worked swiftly, and on the mimic plain, the fire came racing. Frantically, the teams were caught, the camp dismantled. The prairie schooners rocked away, followed by antelope, elk, and buffalo. The whole prairie was on fire behind them.
After an interlude, cowboys and cowgirls in the Virginia reel on horseback. The floodlights showed a cattle ranch with cowboys roping, riding, skylarking around the dusty corral. Into that careless scene crept the painted Indians. The attack was stealthy. They caught the cowboys off guard and helpless. But while they bound their captives, the victorious war whoops drowning a drumming of hoofbeats. With a blaze of gunfire, Buffalo Bill and his scouts raised in. A dozen Indians lay sprawled in the dust, and the rest ran back to the Badlands.
In the next interlude, young Johnny Baker, in an oversized cowboy hat, did some acrobatic shooting, and a Mexican worked magic with a lariat. The band swung into Gary Owen, the marching song of the 7th Cavalry, Custer's regiment. A scene of light showed the rolling grasslands of the Little Bighorn, with Custer's men fighting off a band of howling Sioux. They tightened their circle, and the Sioux crept closer, firing from behind dead horses, rushing in with drawn blades when their guns were empty. The Indians cut down the doomed regiment. At the end, one man was left standing, George Armstrong Custer, played by the long-haired king of the cowboys, Buck Taylor. He fell under a rain of bullets, and the furious battleground was still. The Indians moved from one grotesque form to another, taking their grim trophies. When they were gone, the strewn field was as silent as in all the eons of the geologic past. But a muffled hoofbeat sounded, and a lone rider halted a foam-flecked horse. The spotlight held him on the littered field, while on the backdrop mountains, a light screen spelled out the words, "Too late." The greatest scout of the Old West bared his head among the fallen, and the scene went dark. Custer had made his last stand.
After a group of Indians had performed the grass dance, the rain dance, the antelope dance, the scenario's final scene showed a mining camp in the Rocky Mountains. To the railway station raced the Pony Express, a dusty rider on a frothing horse. The mailbags were slung onto a new mount. With a staccato of hoofs, the rider raced away toward St. Joe or Sacramento. Then a teamster's voice rang out, and wagon wheels sounded. Up the rocky road rumbled the storied old Deadwood stage. Bandits lay in ambush. With a volley of pistol fire, they halted the 6-mule team and cut them loose from the traces. They shot the passengers and carried away the treasure. But at that moment, the sky darkened. A howling wind began, and a frantic voice cried, "Cyclone!" Tumbleweed fled by, and a storm of leaves swept the arena. Tents tore loose from their guy ropes and fluttered in the air. As the wind moved on to the painted hills, a desolate night fell over the lifeless plain.
When, according to McKay's light cue, the lights came up again, the whole Wild West Company, soldiers and cowboys, Indians and Mexicans, were assembled with tiny Annie Oakley smiling beside long-haired Buffalo Bill. An ovation shook the rafters where the light crew mopped their streaming faces. The winter season had begun with triumph. The final show of the phenomenal extravaganza would take place in 1901.
Did you know something like that happened to me once? I had gone out to dinner. By myself, by chance. I was sitting, having a drink before ordering, when I noticed this beautiful girl sitting just a table away from me, and she also was dining alone. I was thinking of all sorts of impossible scenarios when all of a sudden she started coughing, like she had swallowed something and it went down the wrong pipe. It was a hard cough, and she was holding her chest when all of a sudden one of her eyes popped out. It was a glass eye. The eye bounced off her table, hit the floor, and amazingly, just like that, I reached out and grabbed it in midair. I took my napkin and covered the eye, and, as she had now stopped coughing, walked over to her table and offered it to her. She thanked me profusely, excused herself, and went to the ladies' room. Well, I had finished ordering by the time she returned, and she came over to my table to thank me again, which didn't surprise me. But then she asked if she could join me for dinner, which I did, and she did. We had a wonderful time together and talked very easily about all sorts of things, and she told me some funny stories about frontier days, which is why I remembered this event. And then she invited me back to her apartment for coffee and music. While we were sitting in front of her fireplace, I told her that I had truly enjoyed her company, but was surprised at her last invitation and wondered if she normally was this cordial on a first date. She answered,
"Not at all. In fact, I rather surprised myself. There was just something so special about you. I don't know exactly what it was. You just caught my eye."
Hey, I didn't say it.
You didn't have to.
All right, back to our tall tales. Did you know the story of Wind Wagon Smith? Well, here's the story as it appeared in the Wichita newspaper. It was a gloomy day in Wichita. In the local saloon sat Mayor Jones, Henry Hanker, president of the bank, and Pete Busy, vice president of the Chamber of Commerce. Mayor Jones cast a disparaging look out the door onto the lifeless street.
"We've got to think of something to do, men, or this town is going to die, sure enough," lamented the portly mayor. "What can we do?" cried Mr. Busy. "I've tried and I've tried to stir up some business, but we have got to have something to sell," reported Henry Hanker. They fretted and stewed and fretted some more and finally came to an agreement.
"What this town needs," said Mayor Jones, "is a new mode of coming and going." "A new mode of coming and going," repeated Henry Hanker. "Great Buffalo, I think you're right," said Mr. Busy. "If we could find some fast new way to transport our goods, other than horses and mules, we could put some life in this town and maybe even get some industry." So the trio sat and thought some more, and the Kansas sun began to set. In the local saloon sat Mayor Jones, Henry Hanker, president of the bank, and Peter Busy, vice president of the Chamber of Commerce.
Then, all of a sudden, came hollering and shouting, and the men flew to see what it was all about. "It's a cloud of dust," cried one young man. "No, for sure, it's a prairie duster," cried another. As the dust cloud got closer and closer, the men hung under their hats. The commotion got louder and ripped down Main Street. The dust cleared away. The Wichitans cleared their eyes. "What in the devil is it?" asked Mayor Jones. "I never in all my darn days saw anything like that," cried Peter Busy. "Never in my born days," said Henry Hanker. The people gathered round and viewed the contraption, oohing and aahing, but not standing too close.
"Ahoy!" came a voice from the mighty machine. "Ahoy there, mates!" A swaggered young man stepped down from the craft and swooped his hat to the ladies. "Who are you?" demanded the mayor. "What is that thing?" said Peter Busy. "I'm Wind Wagon Smith, and this here's my vessel. Right pretty ship, eh?"
The men could see that the craft was a wagon, but had some added attractions. A simple mast was geared to the top, and a rudder was built to the back. "I've been sailing the grass of the prairies using the fine Kansas wind," said Mr. Smith, "and I'm near out of supplies, townfolk. Can you help?" The mayor and Busy and Hanker and others ushered him into the saloon. A hearty meal later, and Smith became agitated and looking for some fun.
"What goes here?" he asked. "Where's all the excitement I heard about in the bustling town of Wichita?" "Well, we've got a problem here. Great indeed," said the mayor. "Since we're on the prairie here, there's no way to transport quickly what we want need." "Aha," cried Smith, "I think I can help. Let me offer you men a business proposition. If I had a grand prairie schooner, I could travel in 4 days what the mule and horse do in 10. The men stared at him unbelievingly. "Yes, sirree," said Smith. "Your troubles would be over. I could transport people and goods. But I need money, and I need some men to build the craft." "It's crazy," cried Mayor Jones. "Ridiculous," said Peter Busy. "I think it'll work," said Henry Hanker. News of the deal spread through the town, and soon Smith had money and men. They worked and they slaved, and in several weeks, the craft stood ready to go.
Its mast was as high as any good ship to catch all the Kansas wind. The rudder was mighty, and the bow ornate, and the wheels as powerful as can be. "This fine vessel will save us all," said Mayor Jones in a short speech. The dignitaries boarded the handsome vessel, and Wind Wagon Smith took command. As the townspeople pushed the ship from Main Street, its mast caught a big gust of wind.
That's where the legend ends, some say, but others disagree. Seems the wind wagon simply disappeared, which often happens at sea. Its riders have never been seen nor heard, and some say a twister carried them away. But the wagon's still here, others say, and can be seen at sunset on a clear day.
Did you know of the greatest inventor this country ever had? Now, modern school books don't give him much mention, but if you ever lived anywhere between Nebraska and North Dakota, you cannot but have heard about Fiebold Fiebulson. Now, according to Bergstrom Thromberg, now, of course you've heard of Bergstrom Thromberg, Bergstrom was the great-nephew of Fiebold Fiebulson, and without Bergstrom, we wouldn't have any record of all the inventions that Fiebold Fiebulson invented. You see, when Fiebold Fiebulson was inventing, which was pretty much all the time, Bergstrom took time out from school to follow his great-uncle around and make a recording of all his inventions. Oh, I forgot to mention that Fiebold Fiebulson was the great-uncle of Bergstrom Thromberg. That's what made Bergstrom his great-nephew, you see. And, well, come to think of it, maybe that's why the school books don't mention Fiebold Fiebulson, because Bergstrom was still out writing about him.
Well, anyway, according to Bergstrom Thromberg, his great-uncle taught Eli Whitney, Robert Fulton, Alexander Graham Bell, and Thomas Edison all they ever knew about inventing, and even then had thousands of ideas left over. He even sent a letter ahead to a fellow named Bill Gates with a few ideas. Don't know if they did any good, never heard. Anyway, Bergstrom told of the time they called the Year of the Many Rains. That's when Fiebold invented a new kind of animal. Seems that it was raining so much that all the chickens in the country were dying of starvation. There was so much mud that the chickens couldn't walk around to get their victuals. They just sank down in the mire up to their tail feathers and just sat there a-clucking. It was a pitiful sight to see all over the country. Here a-cluck, there a-cluck, everywhere a-cluck-cluck. Just plain pitiful. So Fiebold came to the rescue. First thing he thought of was the feet. So he put webbed feet on the chickens so they could walk around the mud. And then he flattened out their bills so they could better guzzle around the mire for grub. Well, Fiebold didn't know it at the time, but he had invented a new species of fowl. His idea worked so well that when it got dry, the birds didn't want to give up the new equipment. They looked kind of funny, though. Yeah, swimming around and always tipping over and going under the water. People called them ducks. And that's just the way Bergstrom Thromberg told the story.
Fiebold Fiebulson was a great person for worrying about lost energy. He was always telling people to look out, or one day they just might have a big energy crisis. Don't think they listened. Anyway, he was watching his dog one day. He noticed the hound always turned around 3 or 4 times before he'd settle down. He knew why Old Blue did it. Did I mention that Old Blue was the dog's name? Now, he wasn't blue, he was brown, with a big white streak right down between his eyes and on the tip of one ear. Come to think of it, he wasn't very old either. Don't know why they called him Old Blue. Had kind of sad eyes, though. Don't know if that had anything to do with it. Bergstrom never mentioned. Well, anyway, it was a hangover to the days when dogs were wild and lived in tall grass and circled around to pat the grass down first.
Fiebold reckoned Old Blue wasted a lot of energy just to settle down. So he thought on it a while and developed a soft bed on a treadmill, then connected the treadmill up to the well with a pipe leading to a tank. Then Fiebold would start telling Old Blue stories in his life. That made the dog sleepy, which is what Fiebold expected. Old Blue would start circling, which would get the treadmill going, which would start water pumping, and then he'd settle down. Then Fiebold would holler, "Sick 'em!" which would start the dog a-running again. Pretty soon he'd get tired and lay down, and Fiebold would holler, "Sick 'em!" Wouldn't take long, and all the tank was full, and all the livestock was watered.
Well, one night, Fiebold got real tired. He'd been thinking hard all day, and he started upstairs to the bed. After about 3 hours, he realized he wasn't on the stair at all. He was on the treadmill. He rushed outside to see what happened to all the water he pumped. To his dismay, he found that the water had spilled over and then ran down some gopher holes in the ground and right back down into the well again. That same water had been used over and over again. He stamped both feet at the thought of all that wasted energy. He reached down and grabbed that well and ripped it right out of the ground, leaving the water standing right there. Bergstrom said so.
Now, Fiebold Fiebulson always liked to have a little fun with his work. So one year he challenged Swan Swanson to a corn husking contest. This is when he lived down in Nebraska. Now, Swan Swanson was related to Bergstrom Fromberg on his mother's side. It had something to do with the time when there was the big drought and a rainmaker was passing through, beating on a drum and saying that he could make it rain for a price. Well, Bergstrom's grandmother was kind of taken by the rainmaker. She said he reminded her a bit of Burt Lancaster. Well, anyway, Swan showed up in the morning of the contest with his whole crew, told everybody, nobody said I had a husking by myself. Feebolson said it made no matter, and he whipped out his new invention. It looked like something Dr. Zeus might have invented, except Feebold hadn't met Theodore Geisel yet. It had a big bell with lots of twists and spinning wheels and little hands. I guess that was for grabbing the husk, and a spring at the back end to shoot the ear of corn out.
Swan Swanson took a look at the contraption and said, "What in tarnation?" Feebolson said, "It's called a corn husker." Bergstrom thought that was a good name and that someday it might refer to more than just a machine. Well, a shot was fired to start the contest. Swan was driving a cart pulled by three mules. He figured that would take the wind out of Feebold's sails. But Feebold wasn't using sails. He brought his team of jackrabbit mules. Back in those days, the jackrabbits were as big as mules and twice as strong. Must have been something in the water. When those jackrabbits took off, they were half a row down the field before Swan even got his team untraced. That contraption of his was shooting corn out the back, and they were a-thumping off the backboard. They were gaining on Swan with every ear of corn going into the wagon.
But what Feebolson hadn't planned on was the amount of heat coming off this operation. The wagon was getting hot, which made the corn get hot. And the first thing you know, the corn started a-popping. There was so much popcorn lying around it looked like snow. In fact, that's what the jackrabbit mules thought it was. Right then and there, they started shivering and shivering and shivering till they plain shivered themselves to death. When Swan Swanson's wagon caught up to Feebolson, his mules saw all the popcorn snow, and they, too, thinking it was wintertime, started shivering and promptly froze to death. The judges come up, and since the jackrabbit mules were ahead of the ordinary mules, they adjudged Feebolson the winner.
Well, maybe he had won, but Feebold didn't feel like that. He went home, sad, no money, no team, no work. But when he came back next morning, he found the whole area covered with dead animals. They had come to inspect, and seeing all the popcorn and thinking it was snow, they also froze. There were wolves and bears and foxes and skunks, the jackrabbit mules, of course. There was even a pair of dodo birds. They must have got caught in the glacier caused by the popcorn snow. Now, believe you me, there was nothing deader than them two dodo birds. Now, to make a long story short, when Feebolson saw all these dead animals, he whipped out a Swiss Army knife. You know, the one with the pliers and the screwdriver and the scissors? Well, he set to work skinning them. He made more money from the sale of the furs than ever he would have made from farming.
Oh, by the way, Bergstrom Fromberg turned out to be right about that cornhusker machine. They ended up naming a university and the whole state and even all the inhabitants of the state after that contraption. If you ever have a chance, take a look at the state seal. On the back, you see a picture of a man holding something that looks like a bell with a lot of tubes and wheels with little hands, a big spring on the back that says, Feebold Feeboldson, a cornhusker. Bergstrom Fromberg goes on to say that the members of the state were so proud that everyone wanted to meet them. Bergstrom says that once a fellow crossed over to Missouri, and when he crossed the border, a Missouri man said to his neighbor, "Look, there's a corn husker." And the neighbor said, "Show me." Don't look at me. I only know what I read in the papers, and that's what Bergstrom Fromberg wrote.
Meanwhile, gold was discovered in California, and folks came streaming out of St. Louis, Missouri, through Nebraska on their way to the gold fields. It was the big gold rush of 1848. I know, you all think it was 1849 because of the name 49ers. Well, let me set the record straight on that. It was 1848, but here's what happened. Nebraska had been having some mighty cold weather, and they'd been having it for quite a spell. It stayed cold all year long, so winter snow wasn't melting in the spring. It was just getting deeper. By the winter of '48, it became what they call the year of the petrified snow, and every wagon that tried to get through ended either stuck or sliding off into a cornfield. Nothing was moving. Couldn't get through all that year, so it was 1849 before the folks actually got to California.
Well, old Theobald Theobaldson knew something had to be done. So he took all the wagons that he'd used for planting. But see, he equipped them with big nails all around the wheels so that the wagons made holes in the ground as he drove them along. And then seed ran out of a sack and down a chute and into the ground. Drug a rafter from the barn after the wagon to close up the holes. Ooh-wee! Think of the time and energy he saved with that invention. By the way, he had a neighbor by the name of Firestone, old Harvey Firestone. And old Harvey saw Feeble's invention and said it gave him an idea. Wonder what became of old Harvey's and his idea.
Anyway, Theobald Theobaldson drove his wagon over the snow and on out to Southern California to a place called Death Valley. Scotsman lived there by the name of Scotty. Funny name for a Scotsman, isn't it? Scotty. Well, this Scotty had brought himself in loads of sand, said he wanted to build himself a big house out of sand, made it look like a castle even. Theobald brought up his extra sand and hauled it back to spread on the petrified snow. Well, it worked, and early the next spring, the gold miners headed out.
Just one problem. All that bumping along the way, and the wagons lost sand all across the plain, and that's what made the area so dry and barren today. Then when folks got back to Death Valley, they dumped the rest of the sand back around where Scotty had built his house. Kind of looked good, though, the house and the sand together. Old Scotty will have a mighty fine view of the ocean someday, if the weather ever changes. By the way, I hear tell that some fella got the idea of naming some kind of sports team after the gold miners. Just as well they got delayed. The name 48ers just doesn't sound right to me. Now, that's just my thought, not Bergstrom Thromberg's.
Did I ever tell you that my uncle was a Norwegian fisherman? He had once honored by the Norwegian Maritime Association. Some days the fishermen would be out in the fjords for days without hot food. So my uncle invented a battery-powered fork that you could take one bite of fish and heat it up before you ate it. At the awards ceremony, they held my uncle's invention and said, "These are the times that fry men's souls."
Hey, let's go back to the far northwest for our closing story. A bunch of the boys were whooping it up in the Malamute Saloon. The kid that handles the music box was hitting a jag-time tune. Back of the bar in a solo game sat dangerous Dan McGrew, and watching his back was his light of love, the lady that's known as Lou.
When out of the night, which was 50 below, and into the dim and the glare, there stumbled a miner fresh from the creeks, dog dirty and loaded for bear. He looked like a man with a foot in the grave and scarcely the strength of a louse, yet he tilted a poke of dust on the bar and he called for drinks for the house. There was none could place the stranger's face, though we searched ourselves for a clue, but we drank to his health, and the last to drink was Dangerous Dan McGrew.
There's men that somehow just grip your eye and hold them hard like a spell, and such was he, and he looked to me like a man who had lived in hell. With a face most hair and a dreadful stare of a dog whose day is done, as he watered the green stuff in his glass, and the drops fell one by one. Then I got to figuring who he was and wondering what he'd do, and I turned my head, and there watching him was the lady that's known as Lou.
His eyes went rubberin' round the room, and he seemed in a kind of a daze, till at last that old piano fell in the way of his wandering gaze. The ragtime kid was having a drink. There was no one else on the stool. So the stranger stumbles across the room and flops down there like a fool. In a buckskin shirt that was glazed with dirt, he sat, and I saw his sway. Then he clutched the keys with his talon hands. My God, but that man could play.
Were you ever out in the great alone when the moon was awful clear? And the icy mountains hemmed you in with a silence you almost could hear? With only the howl of a timber wolf, and you camp there in the cold, a half-dead thing in a stark-dead world, clean mad for the muck called gold. Well, high overhead, green, yellow, and red, the northern lights swept in bars, then you've haunched what the music meant, hunger and night and the stars.
And a hunger not of the belly kind that's banished with bacons and beans, but the gnawing hunger of lonely men for home and all that it means, for a fireside far from the cares that are, four walls and a roof above, but oh, so crammed full of cozy joy and crowned with a woman's love, a woman dearer than all the world and true as heaven is true. God, how ghastly she looks through her rouge, that lady that's known as Lou.
Then on a sudden the music changed, so soft that you scarce could hear, but you felt your life had been looted clean of all that had once held dear, that someone had stolen the woman you loved, that her love was the devil's lie, that your guts were gone and the best of you was to crawl away and die. 'Twas the crowning cry of a man's despair, and it thrilled you through and through. I guess I'll make it a spread misery, said dangerous Dan McGrew.
The music almost died away, then it burst like a pent-up flood, and it seemed to say, repay, repay, and my eyes went blind with blood. The thought came back of an ancient wrong, and it stung like a frozen lash, and the lust awoke, to kill, to kill. Then the music stopped with a crash. And the stranger turned, and his eyes they burned in a most peculiar way. In a buckskin shirt that was glazed with dirt, he sat, and I saw him sway. Then his lips went in a kind of a grin, and spoke, and his voice was calm. And, boy, said he, you don't know me, and none of you care a damn. But I want to state, and my words are straight, and I bet my poke they're true, that one of you is a hound of hell, and that one is Dan McGrew.
Then I ducked my head, and the lights went out, and two guns blazed in the dark, and a woman screamed, and the lights went up, and two men lay stiff and stark. Pitched on his head and pump full of lead was dangerous Dan McGrew, while the man from the creeks lay clutched to the breast of the lady that's known as Lou.
These are the simple facts of the case, and I guess I ought to know. They say the stranger was crazed with hooch, and I'm not denying it so. I'm not so wise as the lawyer guys, but strictly between us two, the woman that kissed him and pinched his poke was the lady that's known as Lou. This is Kurt Benrood for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program was designed for a print and visually impaired audience.
This is Pam Vesper.
And this is Bob Martin.
Pam Vesper, that ain't your script.
And why tain't it, Kurt Benrood?
'Cause it's mine.
Tisn't.
Tis.
Tisn't.
We'll see about that.
We sure will.
Hey, wait a minute. That's my script. Ow, ow, ow.
Folks, we want to make a special announcement.
Yes, no animals, vegetables, or minerals were injured during the production of this program.
Does that include me?
No!
Oh.